We are in Acts chapter 23. I think we're going to get the whole chapter in today. Last week, or last time, we were Paul was making his defense in front of the crowd there, and he almost got ripped apart limb from limb, and he was saved by the Roman centurion, and then he said, I'm going to turn you over to the Jewish leaders, and you can make present your case before them. That's what he's going to do today. So now he's before the Sanhedrin, which is the equivalent to the United States Supreme Court. It is their Jewish, the high court. And we pick up in verse 1 of chapter 23. So he goes before the Sanhedrin and says, my brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day. Notice he calls them brothers. Why would he call them brothers? They're not followers of Jesus. He's relating back to when he was a member of the same group of people. Probably some of the people that he's talking to were some of the same people he worked with and decided cases with. So he trying to identify with them. So that's, I think, why he calls them brothers. When he says that, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience, it says that this, the high priest Ananias, ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. Now, this guy Ananias is not a very nice guy. There is a lot of information about him in history books. And he was the high priest for about 12 years. And during his reign as the high priest, one of the things that he authorized was when the sacrifices come in, you know, they have to be inspected by the priests and all that. Well, he made a deal with the priests, and they would find something wrong with each sacrifice, and they would give him a kickback. It's total corruption, but that's what they did. Like somebody would come in with a sheep for the Passover, and the priest would look at the sheep and say, yeah, I'm sorry, I see a little flaw there. This sheep won't do. But you're in luck. We're having a special today. I just happen to have a pen of sheep over here that are in really good shape, and you can use one of these sheep as your sacrifice. They're a little bit pricey, but it's worth it because they've already been pre-approved. And you can take this sheep, and it doesn't have to be inspected again. It's already good to go, and you're ready to go. And by the way, you have no use for this sheep, so we'll give you a little trade-in money for this one. Sounds kind of like a car lot, doesn't it? And of course, then they would just take this sheep and put it right back in the other pen. It was total corruption. What Ananias did, he allowed this system to be set up right outside the temple, so that it was easy access. When people come right up to the temple, they could get the sheep unapproved by the priest right there. So the priests were making a lot of money. They're kicking back money to Ananias as a result of this. This went on for years and years. Historians talk about it. And over a period of time, the people started figuring it out. And you can imagine how upset they would be when they realized that they had taken all this time to raise the sheep or goat or whatever it was they were sacrificing so that it wouldn't have any blemishes on it. They had picked out the best one. They'd taken all this time to do all this, and it was rejected, not because there was something wrong with it, but because somebody was trying to make some money off of them. So over a period of time, Ananias fell out of favor with the people because he realized what he was doing. I mean, if it was us, if we went to the same car lot and got the same story every time, and we would have, over time, we'd say, don't go to that place. That guy cannot be trusted or whatever. And that's what was happening with them. So he says, he's not a good guy. He orders those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. And Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. So Paul's mad. You order somebody to hit me in the mouth, God is going to strike you. Well, as it turns out, God did strike Ananias. I told you he ruled and reigned as high priest for 12 years. The reason his term expired was because he expired. He was murdered by his own people because he was so corrupt as the high priest. Everybody hated him. So he wound up getting murdered shortly after he orders Paul to be stricken on the face. Paul says, "You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck." How did Paul know about the law, or what law was he talking about? Paul was a student of the law. He was a Pharisee. He was on the Sanhedrin. He knew exactly what the law is. He knew exactly what you were supposed to do, what you were not supposed to do. And he knew that it was illegal under Jewish law for a man to be struck without being convicted of some sort of offense, some sort of crime. Paul knew that. So he called Ananias into account, saying, "You have broken the law. You are the chief justice of the high court. You've broken the law." The Jewish law system was highly sophisticated. It wasn't just a bunch of guys coming around and deciding what they wanted to do and condemning who they wanted to condemn. They had rules and regulations. They had rules of procedure that they had to follow. To give you an idea, it would be like, if you can imagine our Supreme Court being televised on TV, and you're watching two people arguing before the Supreme Court, and the Chief Justice, which would be Judge Roberts, after he hears something from one of the complainants or respondents that he doesn't like, he orders the bailiff, "Go over here and hit him in the mouth." If we saw that on TV, we would be aghast. We would say, "You can't do that. I don't care what your position is. You're not above the law. The law says, that you have to be respectful to these people. There are rules and regulations, but you can't just order somebody to be hit in the mouth." That's the reason Paul was so mad at the time. He knew that this was a clear violation of the law. Verse 4, "Those who were standing near Paul said, 'How dare you insult God's high priest?' Paul replied, 'Brothers,'" again he calls them brothers, "'I didn't realize that he was the high priest. For it's written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people.'" Paul knew scripture backwards and forwards. And he said, "Oops, I made a mistake. The reason I made a mistake is I didn't know he was a high priest." Why didn't he know he was the high priest? Could be a number of reasons. Number one, Paul's been out of town for a while. He probably took over since the last time Paul was in town. Paul just didn't know who he was. Number two, could have been, Paul's got a problem with his eyesight. He talks about it in a couple of his letters, epistles, that he can't see good. Perhaps because of on the road to Damascus, he was struck down and he was blinded. Maybe that was some kind of a residual injury to his eyes from that. He couldn't see, but we know he couldn't see good. He has described as having weak eyes. So maybe Paul couldn't see the guy. A third reason is maybe they were not in an official setting. Maybe he wasn't behind the bench where he was supposed to be. Maybe it was just a big crowd of people and he just shouts from the crowd, "Strike him in the mouth." The guys know who he is except for Paul. But anyway, for whatever reason, Paul, when he realized, "Oh, that's the high priest that said that. Even though he was wrong, I don't want to be wrong at the same time." So he says, "I didn't know he was the high priest because I'm supposed to respect the high priest. Even if he's a jerk, I'm still supposed to reject him." So at this point in time, Paul realizes, I think, "I'm in trouble. These people are all against me. I have to do something clever. I have to come up with some way to deflect all the antagonism, all the hatred that's being thrown my way." And he gives something really clever. It's interesting what he says. Verse 6, he says, "Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, 'My brothers, I am a Pharisee.'" Now he's identifying one of the two groups. "I'm a Pharisee, a descendant from Pharisees. I stand on trial today because of the hope of the resurrection of the dead." So what does Paul cleverly do? He deflects. He says, "This isn't about me. This isn't about what happened in the temple yesterday or last week. This isn't about supposedly me bringing somebody into the temple that didn't belong in the temple, which never happened. It's not about that. What this is really about is about whether or not there's a resurrection of the dead. Well, immediately, the Pharisees identify with Paul, not only because he was a Pharisee, but because he's taken their position that, yes, there is a resurrection of the dead. The Sadducees, on the other side, don't believe in the resurrection. They are the liberals of the day. They think when you die, that's it. There's nothing. There's no afterlife. There's no spirits. They don't believe that people could have demons in them, possessed by demons. Sadducees didn't believe any of that. So there's a constant conflict going on between the Pharisees and Sadducees. So this just, Paul just, you know, it's like throwing a match over some gasoline. And then he stands back and lets these two people start arguing. So here goes the argument. Verse 7, when he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say there's no resurrection, that they're neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees believe all these things. There was a great uproar. And some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously. We find nothing wrong with this man, they said. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him? So Paul's got him thinking the right way now. Got him thinking about on terms of whether or not there are spirits, angels, whether or not there's a resurrection. He's got him arguing on the right thing. The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. It's kind of like the old Western when they're in the bar and somebody spills a beer on somebody and he gets hit, and all of a sudden everybody starts fighting against everybody, and the original guy crawls out under the doors and stands there and watches the fight. This is what I picture Paul doing at this time. But the Claudius Lysias, he's the same guy that's already rescued him, I think, three times. This, I think, is his fourth time rescuing Paul. He sees once again there's this riot taking place. He says, I better get him out of there because they're going to turn on him. Somebody's going to stomp on him or something. So it says, he ordered the troops to take him to go down and take him away from there by force and bringing into the barracks. Remember the picture I showed you about the barracks that were next door to the temple last time. So he protects him again. Now, verse 11. Total change of subject. It says, the following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify about me in Rome. What's the Lord saying to him? Paul, I'm not done with you yet. Take courage. Don't be discouraged. We got some work to do. You got some places to go. It's not going to end right here. You don't have to. I know you've been, first of all, you were deserted by your friends, by James and the apostles. They're the ones that told you to go in the temple to begin with, and then they weren't there to help you. I know that's got to be discouraging, Paul. And then you tried to share with your Jewish brothers, who you have a background with, and they rejected you, the first riot. And then you tried to share with your brothers in the Sanhedrin, your former brothers in the Sanhedrin. They hate you. Sadducees hate you. And then, on top of all that, the Romans throw you in jail. You're a man without a country. You're a man without a friend, Paul. I know that. So this is what Paul's thinking, I believe. And I believe because of that, the Lord came to him to give him a word of encouragement. Because Jesus knew how much Paul could take, and he knew what his breaking point was. And I'm thinking Paul was right at his breaking point at this point in time, that he just was ready to give up. And right at that point, Jesus steps in, gives him a word of encouragement. And I think that today, he still does that for all of us. I don't know where everybody's at right now. You might be having a great week. You might be having a lousy week. Somebody just shook their head no to the great week, so I know somebody's having a lousy week. But I have found in my life that when I reach a point where I really get discouraged, That's when Jesus shows up. I was thinking, trying to think last night of an example of that. And I remembered something that happened quite some time ago. And I might have shared this a long time ago, but I don't think most of you have heard it or may not remember it. But I was lawyering down in Sarasota. I got a phone call from my brother one day, and he had a car that he wanted to sell me. And we worked out a deal, and everything was fine, and paid him for the car, and he gave me the title. In Florida, they do car titles differently in North Carolina. North Carolina, you go down to the tag office, you give them the title, and they tell you how much your car is worth for tax purposes, and then they charge you the tax. You know how it goes. In Florida, they don't do that. In Florida, you go down and you tell them how much the car is worth, and then they tax you based on what you tell them. And you have to be within a certain range. You can't go crazy with it. You can't tell them a $40,000 car is worth $4,000, because if they check it out, you get punished. Anyway, you tell them how much the car is worth. Well, my brother hands me the title, and he says, now when you go down to the tag office, they're going to notice that both our names or the last names are the same. You just tell them it's a gift. Because in Florida, if somebody gives you a car, you don't have to pay any sales tax at all. But I didn't get it as a gift. I bought it from them. So now I got a dilemma. What do I do? So I'm sitting there thinking about it. What am I going to do? Well, I got convicted over this. I felt like it was wrong for me to go into the tag office just to try to save some sales tax money and lie when they say, is this a gift? Because I could have got away with it easy. But for some reason, in this particular situation, the Lord convicted me and said, don't do that. Don't do that. So I said, okay, Lord, I'm going to do what you say. I'm going to go down there and pay the sales tax. This is hard for a guy like me, by the way. I just want you to know. So I go down to the tag office, and I hand the lady the tag. And she's doing her little keyboard strokes here. She says, Bomar. She said, is this a family member of yours? I said, yeah. And she looks both ways, and she leans over the counter. And she says, all you got to say is it's a gift. And I don't have to charge you sales tax. Now I've got approval from a representative of the state of Florida that it's okay to lie about this, right, and save the money. And I was tempted once again to do it. But the Lord spoke to me right there on the spot and said, da-da-da-da-da-da. I told you what to do. I don't care what she says. You know what the right thing to do is. It's getting harder and harder for me to do the right thing. But I summoned up enough, I don't know, discipline maybe is the word. I said, you know what? He is my brother, but I bought the car from him. And I think it would be better if I paid the tax. She kind of rolled her eyes and said, okay, if you want to. So she finished the thing. I paid everything. I said, by the way, how much was that? How much extra did I have to pay because of declaring this as a sale? And she, $119. So I could have saved $119 by calling it a gift. She said, yes. I said, okay, I just wanted to know. Thank you. And I left there. And I went back to the office. And I said, Lord, I know you wanted me to do that, but it was really hard. And I don't know why you wanted me to do that. Thought about it all day long. Kind of started thinking, yeah, should I have done that? You know, you start thinking all the things you can do with $119. This was back when $119 was a lot of money. Okay. So I'm riding home from work that day, and I'm still arguing with myself. Did I do the right thing? Blah, 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 blah. Stopped at a traffic light, and I said, why am I reliving this? It's over. And I said, and I'm talking out loud in a car by myself to the Lord. I said, by the way, Lord, if you wanted me to do that, I'm sure you have the ability to get me back $119. And I said it out loud, right? Right? And right when I said that, I was staring at the traffic light, and my eyes focused on something behind the traffic light, which happened to be a gas station sign, which happened to have the price of gas right there on the sign. And the price of gas at that point in time, at that exact time, was $1.19. And as I said, you're able to get me that $119 back, aren't you, Lord? My eyes focused, $119. And I said, thank you. I'm going to take that as an answer to prayer. That you just showed me, yeah, you've got the ability. So then I start looking forward to the return of the $119. Everywhere I go, I'm looking for that magic number because I know the Lord's going to get it back to me. He said he would. Every check I get, I see how much it is. Oh, it's not 119. It's got to be exactly 119. Rebate checks, you know, whatever. I'm looking for it. Bank errors, who knows what. Time goes by. I don't see the $119. I start getting a little bit upset about it, a little bit discouraged about it. Months go by. No $119. I forget about it. It ain't going to happen. So I just kind of put it out of my mind. I did the right thing. I just didn't read the Lord right. I didn't hear from him. Whatever. But I'm not going to be bitter about it. Well, hello there, Karen. Come on in and join us. So, months go by. I get a call from my brother. He says, hey, I've got this old pickup truck that you've liked, and I'm going to get a new one. Do you want to buy this pickup truck? I said, yeah, I do want to get that old pickup truck, that old blue pickup truck we used to have. He said, okay, we agreed on a price. I don't remember what the price was. We agreed on a price. I'll bring you the truck and the title. So he comes down. He hands me the title. This is like 6 months later. And he says, he must have forgot what he told me before. He says, now, it's got Bomar and Bomar on the title. When you go down to the tag office, all you got to do is tell them it's a gift and they won't charge a sales tax. I remember it. Thank you. I got it. So he leaves. I'm sitting at my desk looking at that title and saying, I've got to go through this again. I've got to go through this same struggle of doing the right thing when I can easily get away with it. And God, you didn't come through. You told me you were going to give me the money back the first time. And I don't think I'm going to do it this time. That point where I was at, I was getting really discouraged. I kind of felt like Paul in the prison. I'm doing the right things. It doesn't seem like I'm getting the right results. I'm sitting there pondering this, getting really discouraged. About that time, right outside my office where my secretary used to sit, I hear this commotion. It sounds like a chair falling over, and she screams. And I said, what in the world is going on out there? And she gets up off the floor and she said, this chair. She said, I am sick and tired of this chair. The wheel, one of the wheels, the little casters, every once in a while she'd lean over and the caster would fall out. Have you ever had that on a chair? And then when you lean back, wham, you go over. Well, this happened to her. She said, this happened to me several times. I'm tired of falling out of this chair. Would you please get me a new chair? And I said, yes, I'll get you a new chair. I'm sorry I didn't know all this was going on. Mail had just come in. I looked on my desk. Right there on the top of my stack was an office supply magazine that you order office chairs and things out of. That's the way they used to do things. So I said, here's a magazine. Find you a chair in there that you want, and we'll order it. She said, thank you. So she got the magazine. So I'm still sitting in there, pouting, feeling sorry for myself. She comes back in about 5 minutes later with the magazine with a big red marker. This is the chair I want. She puts it on my desk. So I said, okay. So I take a glance at the chair. $119 for this chair. And I thought, now wait a minute. Lord, I said I wanted you to give me $119. I don't want to spend an extra $119. You have done just the opposite of what I thought you were going to do. And I'll tell you what, I really was discouraged. It bothered me a lot more than it should have. It probably wouldn't have bothered most of you, but to me it bothered me. Because I felt like, not just the money, but I felt kind of violated, God wasn't holding up his end of the deal. If I'm going to step out and do something on faith, I'd like to see some kind of appreciation. So, I'm sitting there fuming, and the Lord spoke to me. And he's only done this a couple of times in my life. I don't hear the voice of God, except on very rare occasions. I probably can think of maybe three times in my life when he actually said something specific. This was one of the three times. And he simply said, go upstairs. Go upstairs. Okay, we headed upstairs. So I went upstairs. And I'm looking around upstairs. That's where the law books and everything used to be. And there was a door kind of leading to an attic upstairs. I opened the door, looked kind of in there, and there was a chair sitting in there. And I thought, that's an interesting chair. It doesn't look like anybody's using it, sitting in an attic. So I went back downstairs and went to the guy who owned the building and said, there's a chair up in the attic. And my secretary needs a chair, and I think that'll work for her. Do you have any plans for it? He said, no. He said, you can have it. If it's up in the attic, just take it. I said, oh, well, thank you. So I went up and got the chair. Well, my secretary had gone to lunch or something. So I switched her chairs, took the other one outside and threw it in the dumpster. And so she comes back from lunch and she goes, oh, this is great. How did you get the chair delivered so fast? So this is exciting. I said, that's not the same chair that was in the magazine. And she says, yes, it is. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, look, here's the picture. Here's the picture of the chair. Here's the chair. It's the same exact chair that's in the magazine that cost $119. Thank you, Lord. That gave me the encouragement I needed to go down to the tag office, declare the sale, and go ahead. Because what did God do? He gave me back $119. Now, he waited a while. He played with me a little bit. he allowed me to go through this process of struggling through it. I think it was about 6 months, if I'm not mistaken. But a lot of things happened as a result of that. A lot of valuable things happened to me that would not have happened had I got it the next day or whatever. It didn't mean as much because I didn't have to struggle through it. I didn't have to think it through and reason through it and all that. Well, that's my $119 chair story. And I kind of think that Paul might have been going through the same thing right at this point in time. I'm kind of thinking Paul might have said, you know what, this just is not working out. This is not the way you led me to believe it was going to happen. I thought I was going to be the most popular guy in the neighborhood and people are going to be following me around and loving me and praising me, and here I'm getting beat up everywhere I go. And everybody that I had any kind of identification with is rejecting me. And I think it was at that point that Jesus waited until that point, and then he gave the message to Paul. Paul, take courage, he says. Be encouraged. Everything's going to work out. You're right where I want you to be. Everything's going to be fine. When you think about back to my chair, think about the coincidences of how everything happened the way it did. It all lined up. It went 6 months to the day when I actually needed that encouragement. God waited for that day, for the wheel to fall off of the chair, for the magazine to come in and be sitting on the top of my stack of stuff, for my secretary to pick the exact chair, for God to speak to me to say, go upstairs, for there to be a chair upstairs, for my boss to say, you can have the chair. All of those things had to be orchestrated at an exact time. That's what he did for me. That's what I think he's doing for Paul. Well, let's get back to, before I run out of time, let's get back to scriptures. Verse 12. Next morning, some Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves. By the way, the trial's over. It ended in chaos. They formed a conspiracy, had an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. What a bunch of great guys, huh? More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They must have really hated this guy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We've taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul." Think about that. The chief priests said, "Sounds good to me. Let's do it." These are supposed to be men of God, leaders of God. They're okaying a murder. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petitioned the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case, and we're ready to kill him before he gets here. But when the son of Paul's sister heard of the plot, he went to the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." So he took him to the commander. The centurion said, "Paul the prisoner sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you." Commander took the young man by the hand, drew him to the side, and said, "What is it you want to tell me?" He told him the story. "You've agreed to kill Paul. Don't give in to them, because more than 40 of them are waiting to ambush him. They've taken an oath not to eat or drink until they've killed him. They're now ready now, waiting for your consent to their request." The commander dismissed the young man with this warning: "Don't tell anybody what you've reported to me." Then he called two of his centurions and ordered them, "Get a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen." That's 470 people, I believe. "To go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Provide horses for Paul so that he may be taken safely to the governor." So, Paul is given an armed escort of 470 people. Picture the scene. They're leaving. A group of 40 is standing outside waiting, thinking he's coming to go before the Sanhedrin with their daggers in hand and their stomachs growling. And they see 470, is that what I said? People on horses and spears trotting by, and Paul right in the middle at him, waving at him as he goes by, knowing what they're going to do. Can you imagine how furious they must have been? And how hungry they must have been, because he's heading for Caesarea. That's like, 60 miles away, I think. So off he goes. I often wondered what happened to those guys. But anyway, it says the centurion wrote a letter to Claudius. His name was Claudius Lysias, and he sends it to Governor Felix. And before I get into the letter, let me tell you a little bit about Felix. I told you a little bit about Ananias. Felix was an unusual person because he was the only Roman leader. He would be the equivalent role that Pilate had in Jesus' time. He's the only governor in Roman history that at one time was a slave. He started out as a slave and somehow or another gained curry, access, favor, whatever, worked his way up the ladder, and was actually appointed to be a governor. There is a Jewish, not a Jewish, a historian of that time period named Tacitus. And Tacitus wrote about this particular governor, Felix. Here's the quote. He says, "He executes the prerogatives of a king with the spirit of a slave." What he meant by that was, he was ruthless. He was looking for vengeance. He was always trying to get back at the people who treated him poorly when he was a slave. It could have been his masters. It could have been the people in the marketplace. It could have been anybody who spit on him or despised him or whatever. He's always looking to get back at people who he felt like treated him unfairly. That was his life. That was Felix's life as a ruler. So, this is the guy that now Paul is standing in front of. The letter says, "Greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and they were about to kill him, but I came in with my troops and I rescued him, for I had learned that he's a Roman citizen." He leaves out a part, by the way. He leaves out the part where he was arrested, put in chains, and about to be flogged, because he would get in trouble if anybody found out about that. So he kind of skips over that part. And he says, "I wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. I found out that the accusation had to do with questions about their law. But there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. And when I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once, and I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him." So, what he's saying, Claudius Lysias is saying, is, "I'm washing my hands of this guy. I almost got in trouble with him. I don't want to have anything else to do with him. I want somebody to take over so that people forget about me, forget that I put him in chains, forget that I was about to beat him. He's your problem now, Felix." So the soldiers, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. The next day they let the cavalry go on with them and they returned to the barracks. And when the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor and handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter that I just read to you, asked what province he was from, and learning it was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear your case when your accusers get here. I have jurisdiction based upon where you're from. I have the authority to hear your case." He says, then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. End of the chapter. Paul was not put into prison. He wasn't put in a dungeon this time. Herod's palace. This is a lovely place on the Mediterranean seashore, and Paul was going to wind up spending 2 years there waiting for ultimately his day at trial. But he's in a comfortable place, and he has the opportunity to visit friends and to do some writing, things like that. So Paul's actually, after being told by Jesus, "Everything's okay, we're going to go to Rome," he really kind of has a little bit of a vacation here, a little bit of a time. It's not an uncomfortable place for him to be. Next time we'll see Paul actually, he's preached to the crowds, he's preached to the Sanhedrin. Next time he's going to preach to the Gentile leaders, to the Romans, which is one of his callings. God said, "I'm going to send you to high officials, to government officials. You're going to be preaching to them." So next time we're going to do that. Let me leave you with this. I want to go back to the angel, or Jesus speaking to Paul, giving him encouragement, and my story of my encouragement, and to remind you that of this. If you're struggling, again, I don't know where everybody's at. There very well may be a godly reason for your struggle. God may be wanting you to go through this struggle because he desires communication with you. He desires communion with you. He wants you to work it out with him. He wants you to tell him what's on your heart. He wants you to talk to him as if you're talking to a family member, whatever. And he wants to develop intimacy with you through this process. That very well may be the case. And if it's not happening to you right now, it may happen this week, this month, who knows what. But just understand that there are different kinds of storms that come our way. There are the storms of correction where we need to be corrected. But there's also storms of direction where God's trying to get you to do something. And there's also storms where God is trying to get you more in tune with what he wants you to think and make you more mature in your faith. So that could be that kind of thing going on if you're struggling with something. So I just want to keep that in mind, that whatever you might be struggling with, take it to the Lord. Don't be bitter about it, but just look to him and look for answers from him. He will come through at just the right time. We serve an on-time God. He's rarely early. He's never late. He's always right on time. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time together as we look through Paul's life. And Lord, I just pray for everyone listening to my voice now who may be struggling, maybe discouraged about something that's going on in their life. I pray that they would be encouraged by this message to know that you are on time and you've got a plan for everything and you know exactly what you're doing. The thing that you desire is intimacy with us. And sometimes you let us go through these valleys, Lord, so that we can come out of the valley stronger and we can come out with more of a realization that you are who you say you are and that you will take care of us and meet our needs. So I just pray that anybody struggling right now would be encouraged with that message. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.